Hello and welcome to the Nourish Balance Thrive podcast. My name is Christopher Kelly. It would be hard to find any health practitioner, traditional, functional or otherwise, who doesn't acknowledge the importance of consuming omega-3 fatty acids. Supplements in the form of fish oil or krill oil are widely recommended and consumed and come with claims of cardiovascular disease prevention, cognitive benefits and anti-inflammatory properties. But is it really a good idea to get your omega-3s in a gel cap rather than from food? And do they really do everything the media would have you believe? On this podcast, MBT Scientific Director Megan Hall and I discuss omega-3 fatty acids, what they are, what they're good for, and the best ways to get them. Megan outlines the different types of omega-3 and explains why some are better than others. She also explains why some health claims are overblown and why buying fish oil supplements may not be the best health strategy. Be sure to follow along with the outline that Megan prepared for this podcast. You can find that at nourishbalancethrive.com/podcasts, or if you poke around inside of your podcast app, you'll surely find the show notes and the link to the outline there. Just before we get into this week's episode, I want to thank everyone who so generously supports this podcast on Patreon. Without your support, we wouldn't be able to keep this podcast independent and free of ads. So thank you. And just a reminder, as a Patreon supporter, not only do you have my eternal gratitude, but also you get some awesome gifts, including 20 to 35% discounts on all supplements we recommend when working with clients, which saves many of our supporters $50 to $100 a month over what they were previously paying on Amazon. So by supporting the podcast, they're actually spending less money each month. In addition to that, you also get access to our office hours, where Megan answers your questions every week. You can submit all your own questions, attend live, as well as listen to all the replays covering everything from the most bioavailable forms of curcumin to compounds that might inhibit detoxification. We've worked really hard to make sure that the bonuses you get are actually way more valuable than what you pay, whatever level you choose to support us at. So if you'd like to support the podcast and get access to the discounts and office hours, just head over to mbt.link and sign up there. Again, that's mbt.link. Thank you so much. Now let's head over to this week's episode with Megan Hall. Well, Megan, how are you doing this morning? How is the lockdown and Colorado weather treating you?
I'm doing well. Colorado weather is good. We had a bunch of snow come in the day before yesterday. That's always nice. And yeah, lockdown's okay.
Okay. And do you like to get out in the snow and play? Are you a skier, snowboarder?
I learned how to snowboard last year. It was the most humbling experience of my life. Now I go up occasionally, and it's a lot of fun.
And last time we talked, you were just transitioning Cooper onto a raw food diet, which I know very well because my dogs have been eating a raw food diet since the beginning. How's that going for Cooper now?
It's great. He loves it. He's pretty much almost fully transferred over.
Transition.
Yeah, he's tolerating it really well. There was maybe a little bit of loose stools in the beginning. Typically, that's, I think, pretty usual because of the organs that are in there. But yeah, his digestive system has gotten used to it and he loves it. Oh my gosh. He loves food in general. He loves anything. He's a lab.
Yeah, of course, he's a lab, right? He'd eat whole raw chicken if you gave him the chance, yeah. I'm sure.
But he especially likes the raw food.
So what is the raw food?
So I get it from a place here in Colorado and it's basically local grass-fed, grass-finished beef, and then they put different organs in it, so kidney, heart, liver. And then they also have a version, which I've tried as well. He doesn't seem to tolerate it as well, but they have one that has like organic fruits and vegetables mixed in, like blueberries and kale okay. and stuff like that. So those are the two that I'm kind of alternating between.
Okay. And is it all minced up, or is it whole bits of animal?
No, it's all minced okay. up, like a ground
okay.
meat.
Yeah, that's kind of cheating, isn't it? Mine is usually... Actually, we do both. I have these like pellet things that are just processed meat with organs and all of that. And then chicken feet. Have you seen chicken feet in the supermarket? They're super cheap.
I used to make bone broth out of chicken feet in college. And I think my roommates thought I was crazy. So yes, I have used it, but not for dog food.
Try it with Cooper. Like I can really notice the difference
really?
In the quality of the dog's coat. I could make up some plausible explanation about the amount of amino acids,
collagen,
proline, and glycine. Yeah. Yeah, collagen and all that in the chicken feet. And maybe that has some effect on the fur. But I really noticed it. And when I took the dogs back to the breeder one time, she really noticed it as well. And she was showing the dog. So she was really interested in the quality of the coat. And she was like, going to get her husband, come and check these dogs out. They're like, feel their coat. And the husband's going, oh God, no, please no. Like he's probably been down this rabbit hole a million times before, you know. Something that improves the outcome at the show and it's very expensive.
So you, but you just give
it
them
definitely
the,
makes a
the
difference.
Raw chicken feet.
Yeah, they'll crunch them right up.
All right.
Yeah, they love them.
Try that. I haven't found them out here because I've looked for bone broth, but maybe I should check some local farms because back in California, they were easy to find at the farmer's market.
Okay, yeah, we just get them at the supermarket. It's not a big deal.
Oh, okay.
And what have you been doing for the gym? I'm curious to know what people, because for me, the gym is a necessary evil and I love to ride my bike. And obviously, lockdown hasn't really affected that. But for other people like you, I think I put you in this class where the gym is like an important part of your social life. It's an important part of who you are. And somebody just took that away from you. So what are you doing instead?
So the gym that I go to actually opened up a handful of months ago, but I haven't been back because I made my garage into a little home gym. So I have like a squat rack and a barbell and some adjustable dumbbells and an adjustable kettlebell and some bands. So I'm pretty much set up for whatever I need. And I've had to get a little bit creative, but it's been fun and I get a good workout. So I don't have to wait for anything at the gym. I don't have to wear a mask. So I think that it's a pretty good situation. I don't really, I mean, other than maybe the social aspect, I don't really care about going back to the gym at this point.
Really? So it's maybe I'm wrong then. It's not an important part of your social life.
Well, I mean, other than maybe the social aspect, and it is.
Okay.
But I don't know if it's worth right now, if it's worth it.
Why do you mean it's worth it? Are you still worried about the risk of infectious disease in the gym?
I just don't want to wear a mask in the gym. I think that's my one thing. It would just be a hassle. But otherwise, I'm not super concerned about like myself getting sick.
Yeah, I'm not sure what I would do, actually. I'm the same as you. I've got some stuff at home, but I've always had some stuff at home because I live so far from a gym. It's like not practical for me to drive 30 minutes or more in each direction to go to the gym. So I've just got the Hex trap bar and some plates and some kettlebells, a TRX. I've got the Rogue Fitness chin-up bar on the end of my shed. And then the BFR. I'm just loving the BFR at the moment. It's just, it feels unreasonably good. Obviously, it doesn't feel good in the moment. But then afterwards, it was someone on our forum pointed out, it seems to give them a cognitive boost. And then once they pointed it out, maybe it was just like the kind of expectation that I started noticing it, but I really notice it. I feel better than I do after a long bike ride, that kind of runner's high that David Reichlin talked about, endocannabinoid system and all of that. And you can get that in 20 minutes with BFR, you know, like I can't get that in 20 minutes on a bike.
I wonder if some of that's actually the like lactate production that goes on, because we know that lactate is a signaling molecule in the brain.
Yeah.
There's some thoughts that it can induce mitochondrial biogenesis. So maybe some of that cognitive boost comes from the excessive amounts of lactate that are produced with BFR.
Yeah, you might be right. You know, people ask me about this stuff. They come to my house and like, what the hell is that? Is it a tourniquet you're putting on? And I've sort of resist the temptation to start talking about lactate and hydrogen ions and all this stuff and say, it just means I don't need to use heavy weight. There's two ways you can look at this. You can either lift heavy weights or you can put these on. I don't have any heavy weights, so I'm putting these on, right? And then afterwards, it makes me feel good. That's all I got. There's no more explanation than that.
I like it a lot.
Well, let's talk about omega-3 fatty acids.
Sure.
And let's start with the definition. What are they and why are they important?
Yeah, so omega-3 fatty acids are a type of polyunsaturated fatty acid that have a chain of hydrocarbons with a methyl group, which is a CH3 at one end of the hydrocarbon, and then a carboxyl group, which is a C double bond O, OH at the other. And polyunsaturated fatty acids have at least two double bonds somewhere along their hydrocarbon chain, which is what differentiates them from like a monounsaturated fatty acid or a saturated fatty acid. And omega-3s in particular have a double bond located three carbons away from the methyl end of that fatty acid chain. That's why they're omega-3s. So that's probably way more organic chemistry than anyone wants to know about. So maybe we can just put a picture of some omega-3s in the show notes just so people can say, yeah, this is what it looks like if they're curious.
Yeah, seeing a picture tells 1,000 words, doesn't it? So the two main omega-3s that I think we're going to be talking about today are EPA and DHA, and then perhaps another role for alpha-linolenic ALA, which is alpha-linolenic acid. Can you say the EPA and DHA, the full acid names?
I'll try. Sometimes I stumble over myself, but EPA is eicosapentaenoic acid, and then DHA is docosahexaenoic acid.
So EPA is eicosapentaenoic acid, and DHA is docosahexaenoic acid.
Yeah.
Can you believe these names? It's kind of fun. You look at the words, and you can't figure out how to say it because you don't know where the syllables are. That's all it is. You just can't figure out where the syllables are, but it's a really long word. There's obviously more than one syllable in there, but you don't know where they are.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's interesting.
So that's why we shorten them up to DHA and EPA.
Right. I think scientists do this on purpose to keep ruffians like me out, don't you think?
Potentially. I can see that.
But despite the overly long and complicated name, I think it's easy to make an argument that they are indeed very important. Like there's some facts that like the brain's dry weight is composed of lipids and especially enriched in long chain omega-3s. So it's over half the dry weight of the brain, these long chain omega-3 fatty acids. So obviously very important.
Yeah, absolutely. And the ALA, which you mentioned, was just an alpha-linolenic acid. That one is the plant form of omega-3s, and that's typically the most commonly found omega-3 in the diet. But some would argue, and I would agree, that it's the EPA and the DHA that are most important from a health perspective, and it's those that we'll be talking about today largely.
Okay. And it's important to point out that these nutrients are essential, meaning they must be in your diet. You cannot make them endogenously. Is that correct?
Yeah, absolutely. So essential means that we either don't have this specific desaturase enzymes or we lack sufficient amount of that enzymatic activity for the production of EPA, DHA, ALA. So we, Okay. Yes, we either have to eat them or we have to get them supplementally.
Okay. And so where are they found in our diet?
So ALA, which is the plant form, that's largely found in things like walnuts and flax seeds. Whereas EPA and DHA, those are going to be found in fatty fish. So salmon, sardines, mackerel, herring, anchovies, those kind of fish. And then also to a lesser extent in really high quality, like grass-fed, grass-finished beef, maybe pasture-raised, eggs from pasture-raised hens. Wild game might have some omega-3s, not in the same amount as fatty fish, but that's typically where they're found.
Okay. And you made an important distinction there between these plant-based sources and the animal sources. And I remember before I went paleo, like I'd fall for that, say on the outside of the cereal box in Trader Joe's, that this was a good source of omega-3s. But what they really meant were these plant oils that are perhaps more suitable for conditioning a cricket bat than they are for human consumption.
Yeah, absolutely. And one thing is with the, we'll talk a little bit about more about the omega-3-6 ratio later, but in general, you can't really rely on those plant-based foods rich in ALA for your EPA and DHA because there's really bad conversion of ALA to the EPA and DHA. So the ALA, which is, again, found in those plant sources, the conversion of ALA to EPA is about 6%, which is pretty bad. The conversion of ALA to DHA is even worse. It's 4%. And then to make matters worse, in the context of a diet that's already high in omega-6 polyunsaturated fatty acids, and things like the flax and the walnuts, which have the ALA, also have the omega-6s, that conversion from the ALA to the EPA or DHA is actually reduced further by another 40 to 50%. So really, you have to either get these things through the diet with animal foods and fats, or you need to supplement.
And do you know if the activity of these enzymes improves any if I'm not getting them in my diet? Like that would seem like a reasonable adaptation, wouldn't you say?
I could see why that would be an adaptation. I don't know if that's the case for the enzymatic activity. Yeah, but
okay.
It's okay. Possible. And I just want to kind of mention why these omega-3s, the EPA and DHA are so important. So they have roles in cell membranes. So they help with cell signaling within the cell membrane. They help with the fluidity of the cell membrane. They have some anti-inflammatory properties. They also have important implications for a lot of parts of the body and just bodies as a whole. So particularly the brain, the eye, the immune system, muscles, bones, and then metabolic and cardiovascular health. And DHA in particular, like you mentioned, is very high in the brain, also very high in the retina. And then some issues that are associated with inadequate omega-3 intake would include things like dry eyes, age-related macular degeneration, cardiovascular disease, impaired infant development, especially brain development, dementia and Alzheimer's, and also inflammatory conditions like rheumatoid arthritis. And when it comes to the question of, and people listening who have listened to the podcast before will probably know that we're, whenever possible, about getting things from whole foods versus supplements. So that stance in my mind also is the same here. So there's a lot of reasons to get omega-3s from fatty fish versus from a supplemental source if you possibly can. So you'll get the fatty acids with protein. You'll get the fatty acids with other micronutrients. If you're eating something like salmon or sardines, you'll get selenium, you'll get zinc, you'll get other nutrients, B vitamins. But sometimes supplements can be useful. And we'll talk about some of those scenarios later in the podcast. There's a little bit of controversy around whether or not something like krill oil is better than fish oil. And that question revolves around whether it's the phospholipid form or the ethyl ester or triglyceride form that are more bioavailable. So the claim that krill oil is better because it's in phospholipid form is because it doesn't require the same digestive processes to be absorbed, while the triglyceride and ethyl ester forms do require some extra digestion. So at least in theory, the higher the bioavailability of the fatty acid, the better the incorporation of the omega-3s into the tissues and the cell membranes will be. So we have a couple of studies to answer that question or to kind of give us a better idea about whether krill oil, again, in the phospholipid form, is really that much better than fish oil. And it's important to remember here that we have a lot more studies on fish oil than on krill oil, so there's probably a lot we don't know. And we'll link to all these studies in the show notes in case people really want to get
nerd out on the stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah, certainly the four-quadrant model would predict that whole food sources of omega-3s are superior to the supplements. So I think it's fair to say the ancestral diet includes omega-3s. You call that a quadrant one game level intervention that minimizes environmental mismatch, and supplementing with omega-3s, be it the ethyl esters or krill oil or triglycerides, would be a quadrant three. Would you agree?
Yeah, probably.
So it's like a source code level intervention, but it's minimizing mismatch. That is replacing things that otherwise would have been there in the diet.
Yep.
That is an interesting question though, isn't it? Obviously, humans weren't always living by the ocean, although I'm sure many were. What would you do if you were Homo sapiens landlocked, nowhere near a supply of fish? And one would suppose the omega-3s would come from eating the brains of another animal. You wouldn't just eat the belly of the mussel and leave the rest behind. In fact, you may even prefer the softer parts of the animal that don't need as much cooking, like eating the brain. And certainly when I observe that in my dogs, I learn about nutrition from my dogs. They don't just eat the belly of the mussel. When I give them a whole rabbit, they just cough the whole thing down, including the brain, which presumably includes these omega-3 fatty acids. But of course, for us at the supermarket now, if I go down to New Leaf or Stuff Life in Santa Cruz, I'm probably going to have a hard time trying to find any type of brain for sale. So fish is, I suppose.
I've never have had brain, have you, Chris?
No, I'm not even sure it's legal for sale. Certainly not in the UK. There was, do you remember the Creutzfeldt-Jakob disease, otherwise known as mad cow disease? And that ended the sale of lots of different types of meat. And I'm pretty sure that brain is definitely not back on the market.
So to just briefly go back to the whole krill oil versus fish oil thing. So there was one study that showed krill oil and fish oil had this comparable outcomes in lipids and markers of oxidative stress and inflammation. However, they used actually a lower dose of krill oil compared to fish oil. So the krill oil was 63% of the dose of the fish oil, which suggests to me that krill might have the same effects at a lower dose and thus be more bioavailable. There was another study that suggested that omega-3s from fish oil were better incorporated into plasma phospholipids than fish oil, but that was just a trend. The difference wasn't statistically significant. I don't know what that means clinically, but this study also looked at free fatty acids in the different oils, and krill oil apparently has a decent amount of free fatty acids, about 20%, which may also contribute to the increased bioavailability. And then there was one other study found a slight trend toward an increase, greater increase in plasma omega-3s with krill oil compared to the fish oil. But I think it's important to note, and this is again where like the eating the whole fish comes in, that it might not just be about the phospholipids themselves, but also what else the phospholipids have in them. So for example, nutrients like phosphatidylcholine, which are important parts of the cell membrane, will come packaged with krill oil. So I could see a scenario by which maybe the phosphatidylcholine helps the bioavailability of the krill oil. And we think about egg yolks and liver being really good sources of choline, but maybe krill oil should be on the list as well.
Right. There's one paper in particular I really liked. Megan, as always, has produced a fantastic outline with all of the scientific studies linked in a hierarchy. And there's one paper I found on my own that I thought was really good. I've linked from that same outline. And it pointed out that that's where these long-chain fatty acids are stored in the brain, in phosphatidyl ethylalamine and phosphatidyl serine, and in membrane phospholipids. So it's actually stored that way in the brain. And that kind of is interesting to me. Like, you know, or how should it be stored in a supplement? Maybe how it should be stored in the brain. I don't know. I mean, these are obviously delicate long chain fatty acids that are very prone to oxidation. So maybe the way it's packaged is important.
Yeah, absolutely. Again, we don't have a lot of the data on krill oil, unlike the fish oil. And krill oil is also a little bit more expensive than regular fish oil. So you have to take that into account, even if krill oil might have a slight advantage in bioavailability.
I also wonder about the sustainability of krill oil. I know that krill is an important source of food for some other large marine animals. And I wonder if they really go to town harvesting those. Is that going to have an impact on whales or anything else? Like, I don't know. I'm certainly not an expert in that, but I do wonder about the krill oil, whether it does have a downside.
That's a really good question. We can't just be thinking about ourselves when we're thinking about these supplements and how they're made. And then just another comment on the different types of omega-3s. There are some algal-based supplements that have EPA and DHA, and most plant sources, like I said, will be the purely ALA, but you can get kind of the omega-3 algal-based supplements that would be appropriate for somebody on, say, a vegan or vegetarian diet. And I would definitely say, given the fact that they're not getting any actual sources of EPA and DHA, based off of the fact that that conversion that we talked about is really, really bad, and it does differ from person to person, but most people are quite bad at that conversion, then getting some kind of supplemental algal source would be beneficial.
Is it possible to compare the two? Is the algae just as good as the krill oil and the regular fish oil, for example?
I don't know why it, or how it could be, but at the same time, maybe it is. So I don't know. I know it does. I think the amount of EPA and DHA is a little bit less concentrated in the algal oil versus the fish or krill oil. But at the same time, maybe EPA is EPA and DHA is DHA, regardless of where it's coming from.
Yeah, my guess is that the fish are doing work for you, right? Like the fish are eating the algae and then they're concentrating it along with the heavy metals. No, I'm kidding. Sometimes they do. But one would assume that eating fish is more efficient because the fish has done some work for you.
Yeah, I would think so, but I'm not sure off the top of my head. And I also wanted to talk a little bit about the omega-6-to-3 ratio, because a lot of people talk about this, you know, in the diet or if you're testing in blood. We'll talk about testing later. So like I mentioned, I think there are some pros and cons of looking and thinking about the omega-6-to-3 ratio. So like we just talked about, given a diet that's high in omega-6 polyunsaturated fatty acids, the conversion of ALA to EPA and DHA are worse than usual, which is already bad. And then I think that if we're just thinking about the ratio, more omega-3s without addressing the omega-6s is potentially problematic. So it's important to remember that there are different ways to make that ratio lower. You can increase the numerator, so you can decrease the numerator, you can decrease your omega-6s, or you can increase the denominator, which would be increasing your omega-3s, or you can do both. I'm a fan of doing both. So probably decreasing the amount of omega-6s in your diet coming from seed oils, things like that, and then increasing the amount of omega-3s that you're getting from fatty fish. Just adding extra fish oil on top of an already high omega-6 fatty acid diet probably isn't the answer.
Yeah, this is interesting. This is one of the things that stood the test of time. Julie got some old books down from the attic. I have no idea how they ended up in the attic, but she got some old books down and I was looking through them, you know, the old paleo books from circa 2012. And some of the recommendations were a little suspicious, to say the least, like sort of blanket recommendations on dairy and lentils are evil and no one should eat them ever. Like, I'm not really sure that that's true. Pretty sure that it's not, actually. But, you know, the omega ratio is in there and it does seem to have stood the test of time. But like you said, you can't fix the problem by adding more omega-3s. You've really got to get the omega-6s down. And those omega-6s are so common in processed food, right? So hopefully you've done a pretty good job of that just by switching to a minimally processed diet. My concern is, and this was my naive attempt, first attempt at a paleo-type diet, was you're eating a bazillion nuts, right? That's what I was doing. I was eating a diet that consisted mostly of nuts and eggs and seeds. And so I probably was getting a shit ton of omega-6s through the nuts and seeds and reducing them. In fact, I don't eat any nuts now. I've kind of weaned myself off of them. Hopefully that's improved my 3-to-6 ratio.
Yeah, you can certainly be eating a healthy whole foods paleo or ancestral style diet and still have quite a skewed omega-3-to-6 ratio.
Right.
Now, I also wanted to mention that that doesn't mean, just because there may be some issues with the omega-6-to-3 ratio, that doesn't mean that we shouldn't just ignore it. So optimal dietary ratio seems to be maybe 2-to-1 or even less than that. And there's actually some evidence that humans may have evolved with a dietary ratio of 1-to-1. But current standard Western diets these days can be anywhere from a 10-to-1 ratio of omega-6-to-3 to like a 25-to-1 ratio, which is pretty wild. And some people argue that our skewed ratios probably play a role in many of the chronic inflammatory diseases that we see today. So the ratio is important, but you have to be careful about how you go about fixing it.
That is wild when you think about it. It is sort of testament to how flexible and adaptable humans are. I mean, you've just told me that the brain is made out of this, the retina is made out of this, it's part of every cell membrane, and you can shift the fatty acid composition of the diet that radically, and the thing still works. It's just incredible to me.
Doesn't mean that the human is functioning optimally, but still, yeah.
But that it works at all is amazing.
Yeah, absolutely. The omega-6 to 3 ratio has been associated with a handful of pathologies like insulin resistance, obesity, weight gain in general, and many other chronic inflammatory diseases like cardiovascular disease, cancer, neurodegeneration, autoimmune diseases. And then I also think that it's interesting that adipose tissue handles omega-3s and 6s differently. So arachidonic acid, which is an omega-6 fatty acid, can stimulate adipogenesis and actually inhibit the browning of adipose tissue, while EPA and DHA actually lead to better adipose tissue homeostasis and may actually promote mitochondrial biogenesis in the browning of adipose tissue.
And so are you talking about the brown fat, the type of fat that appears on, where is it, the scapula, the back of the neck and the shoulders there that wastes energy as heat? Ah, yeah, that's super interesting. That was like sort of present in babies, but then later found in adults too, and is a way to waste. I mean, that's kind of what we want in our modern environment that's so rich in energy. We kind of want to waste a bit of it as heat if we can.
Yeah, I'm sure that omega-3s aren't the answer to that, but it's interesting that the adipose tissue responds very differently to omega-6s and omega-3s.
Yeah, of course, it's almost complicated. And we know that, I mean, you in Colorado, if you go outside and you get cold occasionally, I mean, that's important. I mean, your body's not going to waste energy as heat if there's no reason to do it. Whereas, yeah, and of course, you see that, like I can even link to some studies that show at worst metabolic health, when you live in an environment that's heated during the winter and air conditioned during the summer, our bodies are probably adapted to regulate temperature in somewhat extreme environments compared to the indoor environments that we live now. So yeah, it's not obviously not as simple as just saying, oh, well, it's the omega-3s. There's a lot more to it than that.
Yeah, absolutely. Something else that's interesting to note is that omega-3s and 6s have opposing effects on inflammation and metabolic function in the body. So eicosanoids, which are signaling molecules that are derived from fatty acids, omega-6s and omega-3s, the omega-6s tend to give rise to more pro-inflammatory eicosanoids, which have, again, signaling potential in the body, while the EPA and DHA actually give rise to more of the anti-inflammatory eicosanoids. So that ratio of 6s to 3s can also definitely be really important for just general inflammatory balance in the body.
But I get that this is a rule of thumb and not an absolute truth, yes. Right? Like you have to take this.
Yeah. I'm kind of painting omega-6s in a bad light here. Omega-6s are important. Just like omega-3s are important, we just tend to get way too many of them from the wrong sources in the diet.
Right, got it.
And something else I wanted to talk about today, which I think is interesting, and I think my views have evolved over time with this, I'm sure other people's have evolved as well, is whether or not we should be supplementing with grams of fish oil a day. So there are some mouse studies. I know that these are mice, not humans, but they're interesting because they're longevity studies. And they show no longevity effects in mice that are supplemented with omega-3s or omega-6s. And there's some suggestion in that literature that supplementing with extra PUFAs, so the 3s and the 6s, might actually slightly worsen lifespan, which could be due to their potential for lipid peroxidation. And then there was also a recent meta-analysis in JAMA that found no support for omega-3s in the prevention of cardiovascular disease, which is oftentimes where supplemental omega-3s are recommended. Now, omega-3s have definitely been shown to reduce triglycerides and increase HDL cholesterol, which we typically think of as having beneficial effects for metabolic and cardiovascular health. But when we look at this meta-analysis, which was an analysis of 10 trials and over 70,000 people, there was no association between reductions of fatal or non-fatal coronary artery disease or major vascular events with the fish oil supplementation.
Do you know how they got down this route to begin with? Did it begin with some sort of observational data, epidemiology, you know, like, oh, well, people that eat more fish have less heart attacks? Is that how this whole thing started when before they got into the randomized clinical trials?
I actually don't know. I wouldn't be surprised if there was some observation about fish consumption because we have that epidemiological data. But I'm sure some scientists also looked at some mechanism by which EPA and DHA could affect cardiovascular health and outcomes. But I don't know like what the original study was that looked at that. So I do want to say that even though this trial or this meta-analysis didn't support the use of omega-3s for clinical outcomes in cardiovascular disease, that doesn't mean that eating fish is not going to promote health or cardiovascular health, or that perhaps in individual cases, supplementing with omega-3s wouldn't be beneficial. But I do think that this meta-analysis suggests that maybe everyone shouldn't be supplementing with fish oil for cardiovascular health. And right. It's also worth noting that there is some discrepancy between the results of this meta-analysis and other trials, which actually showed some positive effects of omega-3 supplementation for cardiovascular disease. So like a lot of science, I think there's still a lot we don't know. And I'm sure that a lot of variables are at play affecting whether or not someone responds well to omega-3 supplementation when it comes to a particular health outcome like cardiovascular disease and cardiovascular events. I do think that there can be too much of a good thing when it comes to fish oil, even potentially eating fatty fish, although that's one reason that I like to promote the whole food versus the oil is because I think it's easy to pop 5-10 grams of a fish oil. It's hard to eat 5-10 grams daily of an omega-3 fatty acid from fish unless you're eating pounds of fatty fish for breakfast, lunch, and dinner type of thing. So like we already mentioned, we know that PUFAs, polyunsaturated fatty acids, are susceptible to lipid peroxidation, which can lead to downstream oxidative stress and oxidative damage in the body. There are some signs that you may be supplementing too much with fish oil. So those would include very high levels of HDL cholesterol. Now, there are other reasons that HDL can be high. So alcohol can actually increase HDL. Endurance exercise can increase HDL. Just having a higher fat diet can as well. And high HDL isn't always a bad thing. But if somebody is supplementing with a lot of fish oil, for example, I saw a gentleman or I looked at a gentleman's lab work last week and he had HDL levels, I think they were like 120 something. And he was supplementing with a couple grams of fish oil a day on top of eating fatty fish in his diet. I told him just to back off because he probably doesn't need that based off of his HDL levels. And it might even be working against him. So if we're talking very high levels, we're talking, you know, 90, 100 plus. Bleeding. So omega-3s do have a blood thinning effect. So if you find that you're bleeding more than usual or you cut yourself and you can't clot your blood very well, that could be a potential sign that you're taking in too many omega-3s. And people are typically advised to avoid fish oil supplementation when taking other blood thinners like warfarin. Any kinds of signs or symptom of excessive oxidative stress in the body, Chris, you and I did a podcast about that a while back, so we can link to that in the show notes. But look for those signs. GI issues, so general GI upset, loose stools, gas, and acid reflux. Those are not super common side effects, but they can be in some people. And then, interestingly, there was one study that showed that both fasting and postprandial glucose levels were elevated in a type 2 diabetic population taking 8 grams of fish oil a day, which is quite a hefty dose. So potentially some glucose dysregulation there. And then hypotension, especially in people who are already prone to it. And finally, there's also some suggestion of an immunosuppressive effect at very high doses of omega-3 fatty acids. So again, not saying that people should avoid these things, but if you're experiencing these things, taking grams of fish oil a day might be a good idea to back off. Something else to, I think, point out is that many of the positive studies for fish oil have been in diseased populations that aren't healthy. So, Chris, do you take an omega-3 supplement? I should ask.
I do occasionally. Okay. So my wife is pregnant at the moment, and she's taking the Nordic Naturals prenatal high DHA, right? So you already said the EPA is more the anti-inflammatory side. And then DHA is perhaps more important for building brains, right? Which is what Julie's trying to do at the moment. And so she's taking a high DHA supplement and I give it to the kids. I've given it to the kids since they were babies and they'll just take the gel cap and just chew it. And they still do that now. Occasionally they do. And I say occasionally because they are really good at eating Wild Planet sardines and also oysters as well. Like my son will just, in particular, I mean, they both do, but you know, my son wants a snack at, they get hungry at night in a way that we don't. And Julie says, oh, do you want a can of oysters? And he's like, sure. And he'll just smash back a whole can of oysters on his own with nothing great. Else in it. So I don't feel like I really need to worry too much about supplementing additional. And I think you're right. So you pointed out here now, where have we gone? We've gone from like the whole food diet, ancestral diet, which is the quadrant one. And then you could argue that if you're not eating the ancestral diet or if the ancestral diet lacks the omega-3s, then supplementing fish oil would be a quadrant three. But in trying to reverse cardiovascular disease or some other condition in an already diseased population with a randomized control trial using fish oil, well, now we're sort of into a pharmaceutical. That's more of a quadrant four, right? We're sort of tinkering in the source code. Can we fix a problem using high-dose fish oil? It's weird because you're talking about the same substance all along, but kind of at different places in the four-quadrant model. So the reason I think this is helpful is like you almost start with quadrant one, right? Like go for the ancestral diet, including whole fish, I think is the most important bit.
Absolutely. I 100% agree. And the reason I asked, Chris, about you taking extra omega-3s, not in the context of anything else going on, we don't know if you started taking 2-3 grams extra of DHA and EPA a day, if you would see any additional benefit on top of what you're already getting eating oily fish. My guess would be no. And that might be different maybe for your kids who have developing brains, for Julie, who's pregnant. But for myself, for you, there's probably no additional benefit of supplementing on top of eating salmon, sardines, oysters, those kind of things regularly.
Right. It's also pretty low risk, right?
Yeah, just,
you know, 1 or 2 gel capsules a day. That seems pretty low risk to me. Yeah, definitely when you get up into the gram range, now you're in a quadrant four pharmaceutical dose. You know it's an oil that's prone to lipid peroxidation. Probably a bad idea. But I think that just one gel cap a day, that's a pretty low risk intervention, right?
Yeah, I absolutely agree. There's a dose discussion that we should be having here as well. So I don't want to paint omega-3s or omega-3 supplementation in a bad light either, because there are definitely stages of life and scenarios where omega-3s, higher omega-3s, even supplementation can be really beneficial. So omega-3s can definitely be anti-inflammatory, like we talked about in specific contexts and in acute settings. So there are these things called specialized pro-resolving mediators, or SPMs, that are basically metabolic byproducts of omega-3 metabolism, and they have some potent cell signaling effects and properties, and they're also very anti-inflammatory. So StemTalk actually did an episode on SPMs a while back, which we can link to in the show notes, because it was interesting, and it was actually the first I had actually heard of you being able to supplement with SPMs. So since then, I've actually used them with a couple of clients who have had some acute injuries, and they actually seem to work pretty well for healing and inflammation.
Interesting. I do remember listening to that episode of Stem Talk, although I've forgotten almost all of it, and perhaps now would be a good time to go back and re-listen to that. It seems like the clue is in the word resolve, right? Like you need these things to resolve inflammation. Is that right?
Absolutely. And there's some inflammation that's part of the healing process, at least in the beginning. But if that inflammation goes on for too long, then that's where more of the chronic injury and chronic symptoms occur. Traumatic brain injury is another time where a higher dose omega-3 supplementation, particularly DHA, might be helpful for improving neurological outcomes and also mitigating the effects of the injury. And cognitive function in general. So DHA in particular has been shown to be associated with better cognitive outcomes with aging. And that definitely doesn't mean that you should start supplementing with DHA or start eating sardines when you're 60 years old. That means that you do what your family is doing, Chris. You start from pregnancy, you feed your kids fatty fish, you focus on that from pregnancy, development, childhood, and onward, so that you're getting DHA and also EPA throughout the course of your lifetime.
Yeah, there's a really nice paper I've linked to here. That's the one that I mentioned earlier. And it looks at all of the data from many studies. And it's difficult with diet, right? Because we've talked about the difficulty of understanding somebody's diet retrospectively with food frequency questionnaires and all of that. Very, very noisy data often leads to diets that are physiologically implausible. So you know that the data is completely rubbish. But with DHA, they can actually measure the blood concentration of it. And it seems like there's a substantial argument to be made for eating sufficient DHA or supplementation during aging. And that might be important for preventing or even treating mild cognitive impairment and dementia. But like you said, Megan, this is important, right? Like this is not something that starts when you're 65. And this is, you know, direct quote from the paper. Considering the aging of the brain occurs over decades, a general recommendation for maintaining DHA consumption throughout adulthood seems appropriate given the substantial data in aging populations, regardless of cognitive ability or disability.
Yeah. So you don't wait until the problem has already occurred. You take kind of a prophylactic approach.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, going back to the beginning, your brain is made of this stuff, you know, like you have to be eating it.
Yeah. Athletic performance and recovery, that's another area where omega-3s can be beneficial. So omega-3s may have some benefit for athletes due to their anti-inflammatory and antioxidant properties. So they've actually been shown to act as signaling molecules and impact skeletal muscle metabolism and recovery. And there is some evidence, we'll link to a good paper, Chris, that you found in the show notes, that suggests that omega-3s may reduce fatigue, they may improve skeletal muscle metabolic flexibility, they may improve VO2 max and endothelial function, they may increase peak muscle torque, and they may also have a positive impact on muscle protein synthesis through the mTOR pathway. And I think it's important to note that not all of the studies that review looked at used super high doses of omega-3s. Some of them did use a couple of grams, but many of them used a gram or so a day and found some positive outcomes. So while there may be some benefits short-term for high dose supplementation in certain scenarios, I think that talking to the athletes out there, talking to the general population, you can probably get a lot of the training, performance, and recovery benefits from just eating fatty fish 3 to 4 times a week.
I mean, that's the thing though. You say it, it's easy to say, but how many people do you know are doing that? Like, I know so many people that don't eat fish at all. So the supplementation, I'm not surprised that it quite often works in an RCT because no one's eating fish.
That's true. If people would eat more anchovies, sardines, salmon, I think we wouldn't have to have so many people on the supplementation. We already talked a little bit about pregnancy and development, but those are two stages of life that would definitely be important for making sure there's enough omega-3s on board and also using some form of supplementation, especially that's high in DHA. So DHA in the breast milk actually changes with the mother's diet, which is interesting. And like we established, it's very important for developing brains and also cognitive abilities of the offspring.
Right. And of course, the maternal diet, super important. If it's rich in omega-6s, that's probably not going to bode well for the amount of DHA, especially in the breast milk. And so fixing that 3-to-6 ratio in the mother's diet is probably the most important bit.
I would agree. I just want to mention this because I thought it was interesting. So DHA in particular, absolutely important for during pregnancy, during stages of development. But there was a rat study that we'll link to that actually suggested that very, very high levels of omega-3s, we're talking an omega-3-to-6 ratio of 14, which is like 100 times what is considered adequate for pregnancy, may actually have some negative effects on offspring lifespan. But I do think that speaks more to the fact that super high levels of omega-3s can be detrimental, more than it speaks to the fact that normal amounts and even slightly higher than normal amounts are important during pregnancy and child development. Transitioning a little bit into testing, since I'm guessing that this question will come up, I want to briefly address the topic of testing in omega-3 levels. So the best test that we have is called an omega index test, and it looks at the levels of omega-3 fatty acids in red blood cell membranes. Low levels of EPA and DHA using that test have been associated with chronic disease in the literature. And the optimal range of that omega index is greater than 5, and this is based off of the all-cause mortality data using the Framingham Heart Study. Some references I've seen say greater than 8% is ideal for that omega ratio, but I don't think that that range comes from the all-cause mortality data. So that range might be slightly different if we're talking about somebody that already has pre-existing cardiovascular disease or pre-existing cancer, but I definitely think that above 5 is, there's a pretty good evidence to support that.
This might actually be before your time, Megan, but back in the day, we used to do this test on everybody who walked in the door and we gave up. It was no point. If you're eating sardines, then you're going to be in the optimal range. Done deal. Like, should everyone be eating sardines or some other type of oily fish? Well, almost certainly. And so why bother doing the test? I didn't see the point of it. So we stopped.
That's great. I mean, that goes to show that the intervention here comes back to those quadrant one interventions versus doing some kind of fancy test.
Exactly. And it also speaks to that, the wisdom of, somebody else did that test so that you don't have to, right?
Yes, absolutely. So one thing to note on the testing front is that it is the best test we currently have if you want to do one that's directly available to consumers. It has been studied for different disease states in the literature, but it doesn't tell us everything. So optimal levels of EPA and DHA probably differ between different cell types and different tissue types. So for example, like we talked about, DHA is particularly important for the brain, so you might find an optimal DHA ratio for the, or DHA level for the brain is higher than it would be for, say, you know, a different cell or cell membrane in the body. So we've talked a lot about omega-3s. I personally think we've only touched the tip of the iceberg. Chris, if there's anything else you want to talk about, I'm more than happy to. But I just want to say that researchers spend their lives studying these fatty acids. So I don't want to pretend that we've covered everything here because we certainly haven't. But to wrap things up, I think omega-3s definitely play a crucial role in health and development, but I don't think we necessarily have to be or have the data to suggest that more is better. And there's probably a Goldilocks zone where too little is definitely bad, but going overboard is probably not good either for a long period of time for chronic use. And I'm personally not a huge fan of supplementing with high dose omega-3s, especially long-term. I usually prefer to, going back to what we've said multiple times during this podcast, encouraging people to just eat fatty fish. So again, to recap, those would be sardines, mackerel, anchovies, herring, salmon. Black cod is another one that's really, really good. I would say 3 or so, maybe 4 times a week should get you about a gram a day, maybe a little bit over depending on how much you're eating, what kind of fish it is. And that gram a day should be plenty for most people. Other sources of omega-3s in the diet, like we talked about in the beginning, would be things like grass-fed, grass-finished beef, wild game, and also eggs that come from pasture-raised hens. And while we did talk about some of the negative effects of over-supplementing omega-3s, I do think that there can be a time and a place for supplementation. So that would be a vegan or plant-based diet where people aren't getting the EPA and the DHA from the diet. I would recommend an algal omega-3 fish oil in that, or oil in that case, not coming from fish. If somebody just refuses to eat fish for some reason, I would definitely say taking a fish oil would be beneficial. And then also acute inflammation, injury, certain aspects of or periods of life, pregnancy, development, that kind of thing. Supplementation a little bit over what you would get from the diet may be beneficial.
So simple to say, but so depressingly complex in real life, isn't it? I mean, I think part of the problem is there's no culture of fish eating here, at least on the West Coast. Like, people don't generally eat mackerel. It's considered a bait fish. You don't see it very often, or at least I don't. And in the UK, they eat that mackerel all the time. I can remember eating mackerel as a kid even. It's like one of the nutritious foods that I did actually eat as a kid. And it just makes me so sad that we're buying these Wild Planet sardines that are caught here in the Monterey Bay. I think they're somewhere on the Pacific coast, at least. Of course, Cannery Row in Monterey was very famous for the sardines. But then once caught, they go from the Pacific all the way to Thailand to be put in a can and then shipped via Amazon and UPS and all of this stuff back to my house, you know, like that's less than 5 miles away from the ocean. It's just completely bonkers. What is going on here? And yet I go down to the ocean, like I don't know how to fish, but I bought a fishing rod from Amazon and I dip my rod in the ocean, you know, with I can't remember the name of the rig, but it's a Japanese setup, you know, where you've got a line and it's got multiple hooks on it. And all of the hooks have got little fish on them as you pull out, and there's no bait. Like that's how easy it is to pull small oily fish out of the Pacific Ocean here. And yet somehow I'm ordering Wild Planet sardines from the internet. It's just completely nuts. I don't know how to fix it. It's a cultural problem. I mean, in the UK, they've got Billingsgate Fish Market, which is worth a look online if you have a chance, or visiting if you get the chance in London. And I mean, there's just like hundreds and hundreds of variety of small fatty fish. Whereas in the US, you know, fish is either salmon or tuna, right? Like that's it. Like that's all we eat. So there's like a cultural problem there, and I'm not really sure how to solve it.
Yeah. Have you ever had fresh sardines, like not out of the can?
I have. So they're notoriously seasonal. Like that's probably what happened to Cannery Row. It's not that they overfished. It's that there's like natural long cycles of the availability of the sardines. And they've just been through one and they've kind of disappeared again. And so actually that's what I was trying to catch with sardines and I didn't get any. But you do get them in the market here sometimes, and they're really good grilled. They're much bigger than what you get inside of a, you know, the sardine. I mean, sardine just means small fish, right? And so what you get in the can of Wild Planet sardines is much, much smaller than what we can sometimes buy in the market here. And they're completely delicious grilled on the barbecue. Fantastic.
Yeah, they are. I used to eat them all the time back when I was in college. And one day I brought them home for my dad to try because I know he likes fish. And he goes, "Why did you bring me bait?" So again, it's this cultural thing.
Exactly. That's what I'm saying. Yeah, sabiki rig. That's what I'm thinking of. Somebody listening to the podcast was screaming at me, sabiki rig. A sabiki rig is just a little line that you put on the end of your main line that's got 6 hooks on it. And you can get a fish on every single hook every time you throw it in. It doesn't require any bait. It's absolutely incredible. But you've still got to find the time to go down to the beach and do it, right?
That's pretty cool. So unless there's anything else you want to talk about, Chris, we can end there and really encourage people to go out, get some sustainably caught oily fish, have them a couple of times a week, supplement if you need to, or if your circumstances indicate it. But omega-3 is very important for health.
Yeah, I think the only other thing I'd say is that, you know, like it's important for us to model this behavior for our kids. I mean, that's the reason why my boy doesn't, and girl, don't mind smashing back the sardines and oysters, is because they've had them from a very young age and they've seen us eating them from a very young age. And I don't need to give them omega-3 gummies with a bunch of maltodextrin or something to get them to eat it. Like they don't, the Nordic Naturals product is very, very good and it's barely detectable as a fish taste anyway, and they will just chomp down on those capsules. But it's clearly a cultural thing and they're just modeling whatever they've seen us do. And this is dying culture, as we've already said. In fact, I saw a kid's school menu the other day, and someone, the person showing it to me, saying, hey, this is one of the best menus in the country, you should order food for your kid from here. And I look at it, and of course there's the obligatory meatless Monday, right? So there's one day that's completely devoid of protein. Good luck trying to do a good day of learning in an intense, focused way with no protein that day. But let's just set that aside. There was no fish at all on the menu the whole week. And we live by the ocean. And this is supposed to be one of the best school menus in the country. It's just unbelievable. And of course, there are worse menus. My sister lives in the Midwest and she sent me some of the school menus and they are utterly horrifying with like no food on them whatsoever the whole week. It's all food-like substances. But the best in the country, not having any fish when it's on the... We are literally 5 miles from the coast, for me, is completely shocking. So if not for your own brain, if not for your own health and cognitive function and athletic performance, then please model this for your children, because that's the only way they're going to learn. Well, Megan, this is fantastic. Thank you so much. I really appreciate you, as always. If you're listening to this and you've already done some lab work, maybe you've already done the erythrocyte blood test and you'd like Megan to have a look at it, or if you would like to have Megan optimize your diet in any way, you can come to the front page of our website. It's nourishbalancethrive.com. There you will find a button. You can click it and book a free starter session. And that will take place over the phone. Megan can take a look at your history. And perhaps we could share how we'd work with you as part of our elite performance program. Well, thank you so much for listening. I really appreciate you. Until next time, thank you.